The death of seven Israelis at a synagogue at the hands of a Palestinian, another shooting incident resulting in the injury of two Israelis. These incidents may have come as a shock to many, but it falls pale to the number of Palestinians that have been killed at the hands of the Israeli regime. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Israel's security failure, the rise of grassroots Palestinians against the Israeli regime, and whether this new cabinet can even last what appears to be a wave of Palestinian resistance, including Israel's internal crisis with its own people. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Frank Hughes, author and director of Palestine Aid Belfast, joins us from Belfast. Also joining us is Arnold August, author and journalist, who joins us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, gentlemen, welcome to you. Frau Hughes, first to you. So you have seven Israelis that were killed. 21 years old is the age of the person, or the Palestinian who did that. And then in less than 24 hours, you have another two that were injured in a shooting incident. This one was carried out by a 13-year-old. I'm mentioning the age because it's significant in the follow-up questions that I'm going to ask. What's your reaction to what has occurred, first of all?
Well, I think if we put things in context, as you've seen last year in 2022, 150 Palestinians were killed, murdered, summarily executed by the Israeli illegal occupation in the West Bank. And already in January and the first month of 2023, we have had up to 40 Palestinians summarily executed, along with many, many more injured. I think if you look back at the history of the occupation, which is illegal, if you look at the 1 million illegal Zionist Israeli Jewish settlers in the West Bank. This is in contravention of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which states that Israel, as an occupying force, illegally occupying force, should not move its civilian population into the occupied territories. Indeed, in 2002 in Jenin, you had this refugee camp filled with refugees from 1948, when Israel, the Israeli state, was born in bloodshed by terrorism, by many of the people who went on to become the leaders of Israel at that time were branded by the British government as terrorists. In 2002, you had 52 people murdered in Jenin by the illegal Zionist occupation forces. So there is a history going back to 1948 and the Nakba. There's a history going back to 1967 and the illegal occupation of the West Bank, of the continued ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from their land and from their homes. While Israeli settlers build homes illegally on land that has been confiscated or stolen or illegally occupied by the settler movement, they have stolen water resources, they have stolen arable land, and they have occupied the homes of the indigenous population. So when we see heavily armed troops going into Jenin, a refugee camp, in order to summarily arrest and or execute people, you know, you're going to have resistance to this oppression. And Palestinians, under international law, can use any and all means of resistance against this illegal occupation. And with the new right-wing Israeli government heavily kind of indebted to the settler movement, right, and getting a lot of their votes and a lot of their political value from the settler movement, I'm not surprised that settlers have faced the brunt of the Palestinian resistance.
Yeah, point well taken. I mean, if you want to take a look at this, Arnold August, what our guests there said, obviously there's a history there of the way that Palestinians have been violated in so many words. I mean, from the deaths to the detainment to all the core issues that exist. I mean, we can go through, we can't because we don't have the time, but so many ways that they have been violated. Many are not shocked at what has happened. And that is one of the most interesting points, because even Israelis, in terms of the outpouring, if you want to gauge even social media, even though they regret what has happened, but they're not really that shocked as they should be, because Israel has violated Palestinian rights so much, especially with the most recent massacre that occurred in Jenin refugee camp. So wasn't this a natural occurrence, as the Palestinian resistance groups have said, to occur? And this being based on what happened in Jenin with that massacre of the 10 Palestinians?
What you said and what Fred just mentioned as well, I think we're pointing to a very important scenario or analysis, and that is the resistance in Palestine is developing, has been developing for some time. And I guess this is one of the reasons that Israel tries to intimidate the Palestinian resistance, for example, what they did in Jenin. And I would like to say we're not alone in thinking that. I'm a member of the Board of Trustees of the Global Gathering in support of the Palestinian resistance, and they just issued a very powerful statement only a few hours ago in which they say that they fully support the attack against the Israelis in Jerusalem, and is part of this wave of further development of Palestinian resistance using armed struggle. It is their only way. How else can Palestinians defend themselves if it is not for armed struggle? And I think that we are heading in that direction. And it's interesting that, as you mentioned, the reaction from the ground in Israel is not as powerful against this act by the Palestinians as it normally is. But I think it's one thing is clear, that Jerusalem is occupied by United States and Israel. And according to all laws and norms internationally, an occupied people have a right to resist. And this is what happened in Jerusalem yesterday. They had a right to resist. Of course, this is being, the United States, of course, their spokesman, Blinken, and others from the State Department, they didn't blink an eye, they called it a terrorist organization, while at the same time saying, well, we don't have all the facts, what happened in Jerusalem yesterday. We know the facts. The main fact is that Israel, as an arm of the United States, has been carrying on this terrorist activity, as Fra just mentioned, for many years. We're talking about decades, and it is bound to erupt as it has in Jerusalem today, and who knows what will happen again. In fact, there was another attack only a few hours ago, so this is building up, and the armed resistance is building up. And the support of the Islamic Republic of Iran is very important for the morale and also armaments for the Palestinian resistance. This has to come to an end. We are in a stage where no one can turn a blind eye to the massacres, or I would say genocide, ongoing genocide by the Israeli Zionist entity against the Palestinian people.
Okay. Well, I just checked before I asked, I was going to ask you this question, Fra Hughes, as to whether there was an outcome from the cabinet meeting that Netanyahu has held. So far, there's no news on that. And the reason why I'm bringing this topic up is because based on the source of an Israeli journalist and commentator who worked for Israel's Channel 13 News, he has said that the recommendations by Prime Minister Netanyahu will be for a law to deport families of terrorists, in reference to the Palestinians, immediate sealing of terrorist homes, arresting family members and friends, and then sending out reinforcements to the occupied West Bank. And then the last one, which we're going to get into later, approving more gun licenses to the civilian population of Israel. Now, that's really important, and I don't want to have you address this now, because I'm going to ask the question later. But it does not sound appropriate to the degree of violence that you would expect from this cabinet. It almost sounds like they're somewhat intimidated. The tone of what's being proposed is not that extreme, if I may use that word, unless that's an incorrect interpretation of what's being proposed. Because one would think you would think things like, let's go to the terrorists, let's go to the Palestinian homes and get rid of Palestinians, etc. But it doesn't have that type of a tone to it. Am I reading this correctly, first of all?
I'm not sure. I think it's a very extreme reaction. I know over the years it has been Israeli policy, or has been in the past, to knock down the homes of the people who are involved in the resistance and in resistance operations, and indeed to knock down maybe the homes either side or parallel to the home of the Palestinian resistance fighter. I mean, this is actually a punitive revenge and retribution upon the community. This is collective punishment against individual acts. I heard the father of the martyr yesterday, who was involved in the operation in Al-Quds, say that he was unaware that his son was perhaps a member of any paramilitary resistance organization. He stated that, everyone has a different view on the occupation and how to resist that, or how to kind of rebel against what the occupation is doing. So, these community kind of repercussions where you knock down the home of the family. Indeed, it's the first time I've heard of Israel threatening to deport the families. I mean, are they going to deport them to Jordan? Are they going to deport them to Gaza, which is more likely? This is a form of continued ethnic cleansing, a continuation of the Nakba. I mean, if you have an intifada, for example, in the West Bank, and you have tens of thousands of young men, teenage boys, engaged in throwing bricks and bottles at armoured vehicles that can do absolutely no damage to them. When you look at the nine people who were martyred in Jenin, the Israeli army was claiming that there was a gun battle, but no Israeli troops have been injured. So, I mean, where are the guns? Where are the weapons? Where is the video camera surveillance? Because drones were involved and missiles were involved. And I read that their initial raid, that they came in a refrigerated van, in a civilian van, surrounded a house and fired missiles at it. So this is the response of the Israeli offensive forces, is to surround, attack, and apparently there were four people found dead in that building once the Israeli forces withdrew.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
What do you think, Arnold August, about these recommendations that supposedly is going to be brought up in this cabinet meeting? Again, this is not confirmed yet, but I guess they're, and rightly so, says that these are pretty severe and extreme, because some of the comments that I'm reading now on social media are actually pointing towards that, saying they're ethnic cleansing, just like our guest Fraud Hughes there said. Because, for example, law for deporting families of terrorists, again, as Israel sees them, or immediate sealing of terrorist homes, or arresting family members and friends, these are all pretty severe, based on the viewpoint. Do you agree with that, that the steps taken are severe? Because it also points to the extinguishing the Palestinian existence off the land, in a sense.
Yes, it is. It is a very serious set of situations, set of actions that the Israeli government is considering. But I think if they do that, it will backfire, because the Israelis know, whether they admit it or not, but the resistance, the armed resistance, for example, supported in to a large extent by Iran, and the resistance on the ground has been building up for several months now. And I like to, you know, the United States and Israel may be in for a surprise. I like to quote from the board, in which I'm a member, and they say openly that the person who carried that out in Jerusalem, Kari Al-Kam, is a young Magdisi resistance fighter who was breastfeeded with a Palestinian mother's milk. So here we go. While Israel is perhaps going to take some extreme action, the resistance, in my view, has never been stronger than it is now. And also the use of social media by the resistance. We often talk the social media used by United States or Israel, but the social media increasingly being used by the resistance is going to provide a further emphasis, a further impulse to the type of resistance that we're seeing, where the group gathering in Lebanon say openly, we have to use rifles, we have to use arms in order to overthrow the Zionist regime and head towards the liberation of Palestine. Uh-huh. So United States, they must be blustering, but there's the other side of the story as well. Increased development, the increased level of struggle based on any means necessary.
Well, this new phase, some have called it, Frahius, whether you agree or not, is my question to you, where you have these sole individuals, Palestinians, that is, who are emerging and acting on their own, even though they're carrying out pretty sophisticated operation, like what has happened in the past two incidents in the past 24 hours. Now, on the one hand, you have them so young. I mean, we're looking at 21-year-old and a 13-year-old that have carried it out. But it's somewhat smelling a new resistance, isn't it, in terms of the operation being carried out by them, because they have no affiliations with typical resistance groups like Islamic Jihad or Hamas. And one example, good example, I guess, would be a group by the name of Den of Lions that emerged in August of 2022, where they acted against the Israeli regime. Are we looking at this being a more common place incidents of these Palestinians with no affiliations rising up on their own? And of course, it's because they're being choked by the Israeli regime in terms of a variety of things that you're well aware of.
Well, I think one of the major dangers that you've just alluded to for the Israeli state and for the settler movement is that I'm sure there are many brave members of the resistance groups, but I'm sure there are many people who are the eyes and ears of the Israeli security forces, Shin Bet, etc., Mossad, within the West Bank, who do watch the resistance groups, do watch the resistance fighters, do watch the commanders, and do inform on the resistance groups within the West Bank. So if you're going to have individuals and young people with absolutely no affiliations and be seen to be clean operatives, it'll be very difficult to stop these attacks going forward. And there's maybe two things I'd like to say. One of them is, I think it was Golda Meir who said that the old will die and the young will forget. Well, a 21-year-old Palestinian in Al-Quds did not forget, and a 13-year-old boy who apparently his brother has already been martyred by the Israeli illegal occupation. So if you're going to kill 16-year-old boys, you may well find their 13-year-old siblings coming forward demanding a pound of flesh. And it reminds me in many respects of the suicide bombings that happened in and around, I would guess, 2002 with what happened in Jenin. If you keep crushing a people, if you keep destroying their homes, stealing their futures, giving them nightmares instead of dreams of a peaceful future, people have nothing else to react with except their own lives. And if they're willing to submit their lives, to make a point and to fight the oppressive illegal regime that oppresses them and represses them, I think that's something that you'll see more of.
Well, taking a look at Israel right now as we speak, in terms of its occupying Palestine, the land of Palestine. There are protests that are happening, Arnold, August, and I mentioned that in the beginning in my question. You have Israelis that are out there protesting. Now, take a guess as to what they are protesting. Your options would be A, are they protesting how they're against this cabinet, taking laws in their own hand, wanting to reform what they call judiciary, which is under question in terms of it even being a judiciary, or B, it's because of what happened, which is one of the worst attacks. In the past 24 hours, you have 7 Israelis that were killed, some in serious condition, with another 2 in a span of 24 hours. Which do you think they're protesting?
Well, I didn't see the footage of that, nor did I have a chance to read the report.
I'll tell you what they're protesting. They're protesting about those laws. To them, though there's 7 Israelis that were killed in less than 24 hours, that to them is not even a concern, because for them, their concern is how Netanyahu... Arnold August, are you with us? Okay, good. Their concern is how Netanyahu is trying to take laws into its own hands to try to decrease or trying to favor laws to its own favor, trying to reform laws to his own favor. Now, my question is, you have that on the one hand. You have Palestinians, young Palestinians with no affiliations rising up. You have the resistance groups at the same time. These are pulling this new cabinet apart in different directions. What are the chances of it surviving this?
I think, thank you for quoting that. It makes it very clear. So the people in Israel, occupied Palestine, who are demonstrating against the government, even though it may not be very clear, but if they're against the right-wing, very drastic attempts by the Netanyahu government against Palestine, it's very good that they are opposing it and in the streets to demonstrate against this genocidal policy. I'd like to make one comment. You mentioned some people who've been carrying it out these last actions in the last 2 days are not affiliated apparently with any other group. Well, I see this as a positive thing, because the organization of the armed resistance is no longer completely controlled, even though it is a good thing, by the formal resistance, that people are taking things in their own hands. Like 30 young people were killed in Palestine by Israel just in the month of January, and the month is not yet finished. So put yourself in the position of a young Palestinian. They have to fight back, and the only way is by armed resistance.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're going to have to end it. We're fresh out of time. Arnold August there, author and journalist from Montreal. Thank you. And Fry Hughes, author and director of the Palestine Aid Belfast from Belfast. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Batakwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, determination. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of determination in the Islamic lifestyle. What we mean with the determination is that we must decide every day and promise ourselves that what I need to perform, I must have the intention of becoming a perfect human being. I must determine to be the man or the person or the Muslim which Allah wants me. Therefore, the determination is the pure intention of following the right path. In order to have an Islamic lifestyle, we cannot have this Islamic lifestyle unless until we have a firm determination of following the straight path. You know, in every day, in 5-time prayers, twice we say, Ihdina al-sirat al-mustaqim, O Allah, guide me towards the straight path, the straight path, sirat al-mustaqim, sirat al-ladhina an'amta alayhim, the path of those whom you blessed with your blessings. Therefore, I need a determination in my daily prayers, when I'm asking for the right path, therefore it is necessary that in my Islamic lifestyle, in my lifestyle, every day from morning till night, there shouldn't be even a single moment that I'm not determining in order to follow the right path. When I'm asking in the daily prayers twice every time, and 10 times I say Ihdina Sirat al-Mustaqim, then obviously I must have the determination when I'm outside the prayers, when I'm socializing with the people, when I'm working at a place, when I'm studying in the college or university, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of determination in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that it is necessary in order to have an Islamic lifestyle to have a firm determination to follow the straight path. And we ask for the following the straight path from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in our daily prayers. In every prayer, we recite Suratul Hamd twice, in the first rakat and the second rakat. Therefore, in my routine life, other than prayer time, I must strive for such thing which I'm asking in the daily prayer. It is not true, it is not good that a person asks in the daily prayers that, O Allah, guide me to the right path, but he himself never follows or strives or tries to follow the right path. When we say we need to have the determination in the Islamic lifestyle, it means that I avoid all kinds of sins and I perform the wajibat or the obligatory actions or deeds that I need to perform. On the other hand, those deeds and actions which I couldn't perform, maybe I didn't wake up in the morning and I couldn't pray the morning prayers, so I must redo what I have missed. I must perform the things that I have missed. So it is necessary to redo or re-perform the things that we missed in our life. At least when we are alive, we can do by ourselves. So this is what determination means. Determination means to follow the Sharia, to follow the pure intellect, and to follow the right path. And this is what it is being meant by determination. Because when we determine to follow the right path, when we have the determination, pure determination, of performing good deeds and avoiding the evil or the sins, then this is the time where Allah also helps us. He takes us from the darkness towards the light. Allahu waliyyu alladhina amanu yukhrijuhum min adh-dhulumati ilan nur. Because this person has the pure determination, that's why Allah takes him out of the darknesses and takes him towards the light, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The decision to send German and American tanks to Ukraine is continuing to generate controversy. Many believe the move will prolong the war, and there's concern as to how Russia might respond. However, at a parliamentary hearing on Tuesday, EU legislators were told the West should go even further.
Russia is attacking Ukraine from Russian territory, so obviously we should provide the Ukrainians with long-range missiles, obviously.
There are a lot of EU lawmakers who agree.
Any delay to supply Ukraine with needed weaponry and ammunition is more lives lost on the battlefield.
Some argue constantly supplying lethal weapons to Ukraine is foolish.
We're prepared to risk nuclear war in order to continue this US-NATO proxy war. It is total madness. And this European Union and the European Parliament have lost the plot. They've lost the run of themselves.
European Union taxpayers have provided 50 billion euro to Kiev since last March.
What happens to all the money we send to Ukraine? Is it just disappearing into individuals' pockets? Even President Zelensky has had to admit there's a big problem with widespread corruption.
A number of legislators would like to see less division within the EU.
Austria and Hungary just decided we will not deliver weapons. Okay, it's their decision. But that shows already some hesitation or some breakup of unity.
Spanish MEP Javier Nart told his colleagues it's, quote, ridiculous to suggest Ukraine can win the war against Russia. For now, the US and Germany have ruled out providing fighter jets to Ukraine. Others, including France, have not. According to many analysts, the risk that the conflict could escalate further and spiral completely out of control has never been greater. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin visited South Korea this week to reassure officials here that Washington will remain committed to the U.S.-South Korea alliance.
The U.S. commitment to the defense of Korea is ironclad. You heard us say that a number of times, but that's just not a slogan. It is what we're all about. That commitment is ironclad. And our extended deterrence is at the heart of that commitment.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol restarted large-scale joint military exercises with the U.S. last year, although the U.S. reportedly deployed its so-called strategic assets, weapons capable of delivering nuclear bombs. The South Korean leader wants more American firepower at his disposal. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has repeatedly suggested the need for the U.S. to make a stronger demonstration of extended deterrence, its nuclear umbrella. And the South Korean public has grown skeptical of the U.S. alliance, with a majority now advocating that South Korea develop its own nuclear weapons. The U.S. has also pressured South Korea for greater cooperation with Japan in participation in joint drills. Peace advocates find such a trilateral alliance worrisome.
If the South Korea-U.S. and South Korea-U.S.-Japan alliances are established through cooperative military exercises, the South Korean military will now defend Japan and the U.S. mainland in the Pacific, not South Korea. South Korea will then be reduced to an outpost to protect the United States and Japan.
Meanwhile, earlier this week, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg visited South Korea to encourage Seoul to send weapons directly to Ukraine. South Korea is exporting weapons to countries that are sending their own military supplies to Ukraine, but has so far refused to provide Kiev with direct military aid. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In a new decree by the Ministry of Higher Education, the Taliban government ordered universities and private institutions in Afghanistan not to enroll women in the entrance exam of 2023. While this decree strengthens a December decree that totally banned women from education, women feel frustrated about their future educations.
When I first heard that we can't enroll for the entrance exam and saw the decree, I felt frustrated. I had high hopes for my future. I feel terrible about that.
I felt like my life had come to an end when I heard this. To be alive is not just to breathe. One must reach their dreams. I felt deeply sorry and not alive.
While the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, with 57 members of Muslim countries, has called the new decree disappointing, Iran's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, in a press conference expressed his country's readiness to provide any kind of support to Afghanistan in order to restore women's education in the country. Iranian universities had already announced their readiness to hold online classes for the women of Afghanistan. The women in Afghanistan say such a cooperation could be useful.
Once again, we stress that banning girls and women of Afghanistan from education is an improper act and against Islamic teachings. Iran is ready to offer any kind of support needed to upgrade education and reopen schools for the women of Afghanistan in coordination with the interim Afghan government.
Meantime, Afghan women say international community has turned a blind eye to their problems.
Unfortunately, whatever happens in Afghanistan, the international community just condemns it. Online education, on the other hand, is definitely positive, but not as much as face-to-face classes. We women ask the international community to negotiate with the Taliban on reopening the schools.
Education ban in Afghanistan started 500 days ago on girls in 7th to 12th grade, then a ban on universities 2 months ago, and following that, women were banned from working for foreign NGOs and organizations that caused many of these NGOs to stop their mission in Afghanistan. Now, a ban on entrance exam and the question, is there going to be more such restrictions?
In both decrees on women's education ban, a line draws attention saying, until further notice. But nobody really knows if and when this ban will end. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
Nadeem Zahawi, the Conservative Party chairman, fallen from grace for not paying his taxes. He received accolades as vaccine minister during the pandemic and even ran for prime minister last year. His downfall began after it emerged he settled nearly a $6 million dispute with the UK's tax collector, HMRC, during his time as chancellor last summer. An inquiry ordered by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak found Zahawi had breached the ministerial code.
Zahawi is out, but now the focus has shifted to the Prime Minister himself. This week, he'll be facing tough questions in the building behind me about how much he knew about Mr. Zahawi's tax affairs and when.
Zahawi's sacking has also acted as a reminder about Rishi Sunak's reinstatement of Swayla Braverman as Home Secretary last year, after she resigned for breaching the ministerial code by sending a sensitive official document from her personal email account.
Sunak has said he wanted to have a government of integrity, essentially, and it sends the wrong signals in that sense too. We therefore see a government which is drifting and failing to achieve some of its own specific targets. And that's got to be a worry for the Prime Minister and indeed for their election chances.
Speaking of Boris Johnson, he's been named by his supporters as a potential candidate to replace Nadeem Zahawi.
He's seen as a vote magnet, but he's also a trouble magnet. Most recently, we've seen these questions being asked about the chair of the BBC helping him out with a loan. Nothing has been said about law-breaking, but with all of the other problems the Conservatives have, do they really want to risk Boris Johnson in a position where he could bring more intrigue, let's say?
That, in addition to a parliamentary inquiry into whether Boris Johnson misled the House of Commons over Partygate, lockdown rule-breaking drinking sessions during the pandemic, and an investigation into numerous complaints of bullying by Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab. Nadeem Zahawi will be remembered as the minister who played fast and loose with the rules and became the first one to be dismissed by the prime minister. But no one's sure if he will be the last. Saeed Purizep, London. Tensions between Muslims and Hindus in Britain have risen following the recent release of a new BBC documentary, which explores the rise in Hindu extremist politics in India and concerns that India's Prime Minister may be facilitating the increased violence against India's religious minorities. Over the weekend, British Hindu protesters condemned the BBC with a series of demonstrations outside their UK offices. In one case, a British Muslim of Kashmiri descent confronted a group of Modi supporters in Birmingham.
Modi is a terrorist! Modi, that's it! Keep it moving, guys! I love BJP!
Some clashes turned violent, as was seen in Australia, this time between Modi supporters and local Sikhs. The two-part documentary, India, the Modi Question, has not been broadcast in India by the BBC. Despite this, India's federal government banned the film, citing emergency powers under India's controversial information technology laws. An attempt by Indian students to air the programme on Friday in New Delhi led to scuffles and arrests.
Where is our freedom to express? Here we students are not supposed to watch a documentary. If it is hidden, if it is banned, then sure there might be something important in it.
Here in Britain, local activists have expressed concern over the possible spread of the same Hindu supremacist ideology to UK shores.
It's a double standard. When they cry for help, they're seen as the victim. But when we cry for help, we're seen as the aggressors. And the simple fact of the matter is that the extremist Hindu community here in Birmingham, it has been growing in UK, has been growing for some years.
In 2022, two English Midland cities witnessed street clashes between Hindus and Muslims, with locals complaining that the troubles in India had essentially spread via the Indian diaspora to British shores. This new documentary has clearly opened old wounds, which could be traced back to 2002, during the notorious Gujarat pogroms, which left approximately 1,000 Muslims killed. Robert Carter, London.
Pakistan's northwestern city of Peshawar was gripped by fear and chaos after a bomb ripped through a mosque situated close to the police headquarters. The injured were taken to the nearby hospitals by rescue workers. Crowds were seen hurrying to the blast site and hospitals in search of their loved ones.
We were assembled in the mosque for the evening prayers. I was among those who were ready to offer prayers. All of a sudden, a massive explosion occurred and the roof of the mosque collapsed suddenly.
After this attack, the government of Pakistan has vowed to fight back against terrorists until the last drop of their blood.
We will not spare those who want to sabotage the peace of the country. We will chase after them. All political stakeholders should sit together to maintain peace in the country.
Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan initially claimed responsibility for the attack. However, later they distanced themselves from the bombing, saying it was not their policy to target mosques, seminaries, and religious places. Experts say the Pakistani government needs to take up the issue of growing terrorism with neighboring Afghanistan. The Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan militants are said to be hiding in Afghanistan while carrying out attacks inside Pakistan once in a while.
This is really a source of great worry for Pakistan and the security forces of Pakistan. Pakistan was expecting that after the Taliban takeover in Kabul, the terrorism will go down and this tide of terrorism will subside. But that has not happened, unfortunately. The Taliban tried to broker a peace deal between the government of Pakistan and TTP. Parleys were held, talks were held behind the scene between the security forces of Pakistan and the TTP leadership, but that didn't work.
The country's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif has appealed to the people for blood donations for the injured in a terrorist attack in Peshawar on Monday. Pakistan is facing a resurgence of violent attacks in recent months. Analysts believe
that government has to deal decisively with Taliban militants to maintain peace and economic stability of the country. Nasser Kazmi in Islamabad.
The first international conference on media and the unity of the Islamic Ummah kicked off in the capital Tehran on Sunday to discuss ways for the unity of the Islamic Ummah based on media activities. Media activists, managers, and journalists from different Islamic countries attended the first Minaret International Conference held by Iran's World Forum for Proximity of Islamic Schools of Thought. The unity of the Islamic Ummah, media truth and media literacy, and the capacity of international media were the three major axes which were discussed by the participants at the first Minaret International Conference in Tehran.
I have taken part in the first conference on media and Islamic unity because I believe the media play a key role in shedding light on the atrocities of the oppressive regimes like Israel against Palestinians. Islamic media can keep the path of resistance alive and inform more people of what is happening against Palestinians in the occupied lands.
Moreover, the participants in the event, in a statement, condemned the recent insults to the Holy Quran and Islamic sanctities in European countries.
In today's world, media outlets play an important role in creating a campaign against a nation's religion or belief. Western media centers have become the centers for waging war against other countries. The recent sacrilegious moves in European countries against the Holy Quran originates from the same policy. The insulting move hurt the feelings of billions of Muslims and provoked hatred and discord.
The statement also condemned Western governments for planting the seeds of hatred and animosity and fanning the flames of violence in the world. It underscored that Muslims, based on their religious beliefs, never allow themselves to insult the sanctities of other faiths, and that the followers of Islam hold all divine books and prophets in high respect.
The first international conference on media and the unity of the Islamic world is aimed at building capacity, network, and raising awareness among Islamic nations with regard to international development, especially anti-Islam currents, which will further forge unity among Muslims worldwide. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Latest surveys are indicating that more and more people in Italy are against continuing to send weapons to Kyiv and are calling for a peaceful settlement of the conflict in Ukraine. According to a Euromedia poll, over half of Italians, about 52%, oppose supplying Ukraine with modern Western-made weapons, up several percentage points from mid-December. Furthermore, almost 7 out of 10 respondents were also against a possible intervention of NATO in the conflict.
Sending more weapons doesn't make any sense. More arms means more destruction and a never-ending war.
After weeks of doubts, Italy has confirmed it is ready to supply Ukraine with its highly costly SAMP/T air defense system. Italy only has 5 SAMP/T batteries, which has led to concerns over the weakening of the country's defense capability. Also, other polls show a growing opposition among Italians to an even more active role by the Giorgia Meloni government in the conflict. According to a survey commissioned by the state broadcaster RAI, an overwhelming majority of Italians, almost 80%, believe that the Ukraine conflict is far away from them. Another survey carried out by market research company SWG has revealed over half of Italian citizens oppose the government's plans to raise defense spending to 2% of GDP by 2028. Doing so would align the country with NATO's desired threshold.
I think that increasing our spending on weapons now is insane. We are already strangled by high inflation, high cost of living. I'm against the government's plan.
Italy counts very little at an international level. I am afraid it would be much more useful to remain inside the current international context and go with the flow.
Italy's next aid and military package to Ukraine is to be announced by the Meloni government in the early days of February. Max Civili, Rome.
Music.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced a series of punitive steps against Palestinians in response to Friday's shooting in East Al-Quds. The operation, which was carried out by 21-year-old Khaira Alqam from East Al-Quds, killed 7 Israeli settlers and wounded several others. The steps announced late on Saturday during a meeting of the Israeli cabinet included new moves to expand Jewish settlements. The cabinet, however, has not provided details on how settlements would be expanded. Other measures include granting gun permits to Israelis, a move seen as a green light to Israeli civilians' use of guns against Palestinians.
These are parts of more collective punishment, more aggression and crimes against Palestinians. They are speaking about home demolitions and stripping citizenship of the families of those who carry out such operations from the real owners of the land, and more such moves against the people of Al-Quds.
The cabinet also decided more punishments for the families of those who carry out shooting operations by deciding to demolish their homes. Early on Sunday, Israeli troops raided Attur neighborhood where martyr Khaira Alqam came from and sealed up the entrances of his family home in preparation for its demolition. The Israeli cabinet voted to revoke residency and citizenship rights of families of those who carry out shooting operations from Al-Quds and lands occupied in 1948.
The decisions of the Israeli cabinet are only about using much more violence, fierce violence against Palestinian people, and about consolidating the system of racial discrimination and occupation. Their decisions will not change much and will not break the Palestinian resistance. And in my opinion, this government is failing and will continue to fail because fascism cannot prevail. And nobody can break the will of the Palestinian people to struggle to be free.
Friday's operation came only one day after Israeli forces shot dead 9 Palestinians during a raid on a refugee camp in the northern West Bank city of Jenin. That brings to more than 30 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since the start of this year. Observers argue that the Israelis themselves should be now worried about the repercussions of the right-wing regime's policies, including the deadly raid on Jenin. They add that the Palestinians won't fear Netanyahu's further restrictions and collective punishment they already are used to under Tel Aviv's occupation. Mona Qandil for Press TV, Occupied Ramallah.
In the limelight.
The U.S. Treasury has recently announced that the country faces a recession if it defaults on its debt. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Hill wrote in this regard, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned that the U.S. is facing a catastrophic debt crisis if lawmakers fail to raise the borrowing limit, saying the country would face a spiraling recession. Yellen said to Axios in an interview from Johannesburg, South Africa, "It would be devastating. It's a catastrophe," she added. "Of course, it makes me nervous." The U.S. reached its technical borrowing limit of around $31.4 trillion earlier this month, but Yellen has been able to enact accounting moves that will allow the federal government to pay its bills until sometime in June. Before then, lawmakers must agree to lift or suspend the debt ceiling in order for the government to take on new debt to pay its responsibilities. But leaders from both parties seem far apart on a potential compromise. The White House and many Democrats want to raise the debt ceiling quickly, but Republicans want concessions on spending cuts before agreeing to raise the borrowing limit.
We'll be right back.
New York Times also noted Washington and Wall Street are bracing for a revival of brinksmanship over the nation's statutory debt limit, raising fears that the fragile U.S. economy could be rattled by a calamitous self-inflicted wound. For years, Republicans have sought to tie spending cuts or other concessions from Democrats to their votes to lift the borrowing cap, even if it means eroding the world's faith that the United States will always pay its bills. Now back in control of a chamber of Congress, Republicans are poised once again to leverage the debt limit to make fiscal demands of President Biden. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned recently that she would have to undertake extraordinary measures to continue paying the nation's bills beyond January if lawmakers did not act to raise the debt limit, and that her powers to delay a default could be exhausted by early June. The fight over the debt limit is renewing debates about what the actual consequences would be if the U.S. were unable to borrow money to pay its bills, including what it owes to the bondholders who own U.S. Treasury debt and essentially provide a line of credit to the government. Some Republicans argue that the ramifications of breaching the debt limit and defaulting are overblown. Democrats and the White House, along with a variety of economists and forecasters, warn of dire scenarios that include the shutdown of basic government functions, a hobbled public health system, and a deep and painful financial crisis. Also, RT had an eye on this issue, writing, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned of dire consequences the country may be facing if it doesn't hike its statutory debt ceiling in the coming month. According to the senior official, the U.S. could default on its debt by summer, which would lead to a financial crisis. It makes me nervous. It would be devastating. It's a catastrophe, Yellen told Axios News outlet, adding that we will have a financial crisis and I believe we would have recession in the United States. Spending would have to decline to match the tax revenues, Yellen said, which would strip the government of the ability to support the economy with the stimulus. Furthermore, psychological consequences like people fearing to spend money could then further impact the spending and deepen a recession. She noted that a full-blown U.S. debt default would also send ripple effects across the global economy. Yellen said Americans would face higher borrowing costs, and it would cause a good deal of turmoil globally as well. The secretary began to raise the alarm on potential U.S. debt default earlier this month, notifying the U.S. Congress that the Treasury had started to invoke emergency measures to prevent the country from reaching the national debt ceiling, now set at $31.4 trillion. The measures largely involve temporarily suspending payments that are not immediately necessary to keep the government running. Yellen noted at the time, however, that the measures only go as far as to give the Congress time to negotiate and pass a debt limit hike, most likely until early June. She said, without the hike, default would be imminent. The president and the leadership of Congress are responsible to find a way to get the debt ceiling raised, she told Axios. The debt ceiling, which was first enacted by the Congress in 1917, prevents the U.S. Treasury from issuing new government bonds to fund government operations after the debt ceiling is reached. Exceeding that limit means that the federal government's ability to make routine budget payments, including paying for various social expenditures, is at risk. Moreover, the government's ability to pay